There's a lot more to being a SEAL sniper than shooting. As training progressed, I was taught to study the terrain and the surroundings. I learned to see things with the sniper's eye. If I were trying to kill me, where would I set up? That roof. I could take the whole squad from there. Once I identified those spots, I'd spend more time looking at them. I had excellent vision going into the course, but it wasn't so much seeing as learning to perceive, knowing what sort of movement should get your attention, discerning subtle shapes that can tip off a waiting ambush. I had to practice to stay sharp. Observation is hard work. I'd go outside and just train myself to spot things in the distance. I always tried to hone my craft, even on leave. On a ranch in Texas, you see animals, birds. You learn to look in the distance and spot movement, shapes, little inconsistencies in the landscape. For a while, it seemed like everything I did helped train me, even video games. I had a little handheld Mahjong game that a friend of mine had given us as a wedding present. I don't know if it was exactly appropriate as a wedding present. It's a handheld one-person game, but as a training tool, it was invaluable. In Mahjong, you scan different tiles, looking for matches. I would play timed sessions against the computer, working to sharpen my observation skills. I said it before, and I'll keep saying it. I'm not the best shot in the world. There were plenty of guys better than me, even in that class. I only graduated about middle of the pack. As it happened, the guy who was the honor man, or best in our class, was part of our platoon. He never had as many kills as I did, though, at least partly because he was sent to the Philippines for a few months while I spent my time in Iraq. You need skill to be a sniper, but you also need opportunity and luck. Beaten by dolphins, eaten by sharks. After spending the entire summer at sniper school, I returned to my platoon and got busy with the rest of our workup, going through the different training sessions as we prepared to deploy in a year. As usual, I had some of my hardest times in the water. Everyone gets all warm and fuzzy about marine animals, but I've had close and personal encounters that were anything but. While the Navy was testing a program using dolphins for harbor defense, they used us as targets, in a few cases without warning. The dolphins would come out and beat the shit out of us. They were trained to hit in the sides, and they could crack ribs. And if you hadn't been warned in advance of the exercise, you didn't know what was going on. Your first reaction, or at least mine, was to think you were being attacked by sharks. One time we were out and the dolphins were taking it to us. Getting beaten bad, I headed toward shore to dodge the bastards. Spotting some piers, I ducked underneath. I knew they wouldn't follow me. Safe. All of a sudden, something clamped hard on my leg. Hard. It was a sea lion. They were being trained to guard the piers. I went back out into open water. I'd rather be beaten by a dolphin than eaten by a sea lion. But sharks were, by far, the worst. One evening, we were supposed to swim across the bay off San Diego in the dark and plant a limpet mine on a particular ship. Simple, standard SEAL operation. Not every SEAL hates the water like I do. In fact, a lot of them like it so much they'll swim around and play tricks on the others in the exercise. You might have a guy plant his mine, then sink to the bottom and wait for the next guy to come over with his. There's usually enough light from above that the second diver is silhouetted and easy to see. So when the victim, I mean diver, comes to plant his mine, the first diver comes up, grabs his fin, and jerks it. That scares the shit out of the second diver. Usually he thinks there's a shark in the water and screws up the rest of the exercise, and his gear may need a special cleaning. On this particular day, I was beneath the ship and had just planted my mine when something grabbed my fin. Shark! Then I put my heart back in my chest, remembering all the stories and warnings about my brethren SEALs. Just one of the guys messing with my head, I told myself. I turned around to flip him off, and found myself giving the finger to a shark who'd taken a particular liking to my flipper. He had it in his jaw. He wasn't a huge shark, but what he lacked in size he made up for in pure orneriness. I grabbed my knife and cut off my fin. No sense keeping it now that it was all chewed up, right? While he was munching on what remained of it, I swam up to the surface and flagged down the security boat. I grabbed onto the side and explained that they were taking me in right now because there was a shark out here and he was one hungry mother. During another training exercise, this one was before my first deployment, four of us were inserted on the California coast from a submarine. We came ashore in two Zodiacs, built a hide, and did some reconnaissance. When the time came, we all got in our Zodiacs and headed back out to meet the sub and go home. Unfortunately, my officer had given the submarine the wrong grid coordinates for the rendezvous. In fact, they were so far off that there was an island between us and the sub. Of course, we didn't know that at the time. We just circled around, trying to make radio comms with a vessel that was too far away to hear us. At some point, either our radio got wet or the battery drained, and all hope of connection was lost. We spent just about the entire night out on the water in the Zodiacs. Finally, as dawn approached, our fuel was nearly gone. My raft was starting to go flat. We all decided we'd just go back ashore and wait. At least we would get some sleep. As we were coming in, a sea lion swam up, all friendly-like. Being from Texas, I had never really had much of a chance to look at sea lions, so naturally I was curious and started watching this one. He was a pretty interesting, if ugly, critter. All of the sudden, splop, he disappeared below the surface. The next thing I knew, he and we were surrounded by large, pointy fins. Apparently, a number of sharks had decided to make breakfast to him. Sea lions are big, but there were way too many sharks to be satisfied with just him. They started circling closer and closer to the sides of my raft, which looked increasingly thin and perilously close to the water. I glanced toward shore. It was very far off. Holy shit, I thought. I'm gonna get eaten. My companion in the raft was a rather round fellow, at least for a seal. If we go down, I warned him, I'm shooting you. You'll be something for the sharks to munch on while I swim to shore. He just cursed at me. I think he thought I was kidding. I wasn't. Tats. We did finally make shore without getting eaten, but meanwhile the entire Navy was looking for us. The news media started carrying the story, Four Seals Lost at Sea. Not exactly what we wanted to be famous for. It took a while, but a patrol plane finally spotted us and a Mark V was dispatched to pick us up. The commander of the assault boat took care of us and got us home. That was one of the few times when I was really glad to get aboard a boat or ship. Generally, when I've been out at sea, I've been bored. Worrying about being assigned to sea duty was a big motivator during BUDS. Submarines are the worst. Even the largest feel cramped. The last time I was aboard one, we weren't even allowed to work out. The gym was located on the other side of the nuclear reactor from our quarters, and we weren't authorized to pass through the reactor area to get there. Aircraft carriers are a hell of a lot larger, but they can be just as boring. At least they have lounges where you can play video games and there are no restrictions on getting to the gym to blow off steam. In fact, on one occasion, we were specifically requested to go to the gym by the CO. We were on the Kitty Hawk when they were having a problem with gangs. Apparently some punk sailors who were gang members were causing quite a discipline problem aboard ship. The CO of the boat pulled us over and told us when the gang used the gym. So we went down to work out, locked the door behind us, and fixed the gang problem. During this workup, I missed a dive session because I got sick. It was as if a light went off in my head. From that point on, just about every time diving turned up on our practice schedule, I came down with a very bad disease, or I found a sniper training trip that just had to be taken at that point. The rest of the guys teased me that I had better ninja smoke than anybody. And who am I to argue? I also got my first tattoo around this time. I wanted to honor the SEALs, and yet I didn't feel as if I'd earned a trident tattoo. The official SEAL emblem had an eagle perched in an overwatch position on a trident that forms the crossbars of an anchor. A flintlock pistol sits in front of it. The insignia is known as the Trident, or, unofficially, a Budweiser, the reference being to Bud's or the beer, depending on who you ask. So instead I got a frog bone, a tattoo that looks like a frog skeleton. This, too, is a traditional SEAL and UDT symbol, in this case honoring our dead comrades. I have the tattoo on my back, peeking over my shoulder, as if those who came before me were looking after me, offering some protection. Birth. Besides being a SEAL, I was also a husband, and after I came home, Taya and I decided to try and start a family. Things went pretty well. She got pregnant about the first time we kissed without protection, and her pregnancy was near perfect. It was the childbirth that got complicated. For some reason, my wife had a problem with a low platelet count. Unfortunately, the problem wasn't discovered until too late, and because of that, she couldn't get an epidural or other painkiller when it came time to give birth. So she had to give birth naturally, without any training or preparation. Our son was 8 pounds, not a particularly small kid. You learn a lot about a woman when she's under duress. I got bitched to high heaven. She claimed she didn't, but I know better. And who are you going to believe, a SEAL or a SEAL's wife? Taya was in labor for 16 hours. Toward the end, they decided they could give her laughing gas to ease the pain. But before they did, they warned me of everything that could happen to my son, no matter how distant the possibility. I didn't feel I had much of a choice. She was in tremendous pain. She needed relief. I told them to go ahead, though in the back of my mind I was worried that my boy would come out messed up. Then the doctor told me my son was so big he couldn't quite squeeze through the birth canal. They wanted to put a suction thing on his head to help him get out. Meanwhile, Taya was passing out cold between contractions. Okay, I said, not really understanding. The doctor looked at me. He may come out like a cone head. Oh, great, I thought. My child is not only going to be fucked up from the gas, but he's going to be a cone head. God damn it, just get him out of there, I told him. You're killing my wife. Do it. My boy came out just fine. But I have to say, I was a case the whole time. It was the most hopeless feeling in the world, seeing my wife in excruciating pain without anything I could do. I was a hell of a lot more nervous watching her give birth than I ever was in combat. Taya. It was a very emotional time, with tremendous highs and lows. Both of our families were in town for the birth. We were all very happy, and yet, at the same time, we knew Chris would be leaving soon for Iraq. That part sucked. Chris had trouble handling the baby's crying at first, and that stressed me out as well. You can handle war, but you can't handle a few days of crying? Most people don't deal too well with that. Chris certainly wasn't one of the exceptions. I knew that taking care of our son was all going to be on me for the next several months while he was away. More importantly, I knew that all the newness and magic was also going to be with me. I was nervous about how I would handle it, and sad that all the memories of our beautiful son would be mine alone, as opposed to shared memories we could look back on together. At the same time, I was angry he was leaving, and terrified he wouldn't make it back. I also loved him like crazy. NAV School. Besides sniper school, I'd been volunteered for NAV school by my chief. I went reluctantly. Navigating is an important skill in combat. Without a navigator, you don't know how to get to the battle, let alone how to get away when you're done. In a DA, direct action scenario, the navigator figures out the best way to the target, comes up with alternatives, and guides the fire team to safety when you're done. The problem is, SEAL navigators often don't get a chance to actually fight in the DA they navigate to. The way we set things up, the navigator is usually assigned to stay in the vehicle while the rest of the unit breaks into the house or whatever. That's so he can be ready in case we need to get out fast. Sitting in the passenger seat, plugging numbers into a computer was not exactly where I wanted to be. But my chief wanted someone he could count on, planning the routes, and when your chief asks you to do something, you do it. I spent the whole first week of NAV school frowning at a desk in front of a tough book laptop computer, learning the computer's functions, how to hook up to a GPS and manipulate the satellite imagery and maps. I also learned how to take the images and paste them onto PowerPoint for briefings and the like. Yes, even SEALs use PowerPoint. The second week was a little more interesting. We drove around the city, we were in San Diego, plotting and following different routes. I'm not pretending it was cool, though. Important, yes, but not very exciting. As it happened, though, it was my skills as a navigator that got me to Iraq ahead of everyone else.
6. Dealing death. Back to war. Toward the end of our workup, we found out that they were standing up a new unit in Baghdad to do direct action raids on suspected terrorists and resistance leaders. The unit was being run by the GROM, the Polish Special Operations Unit. While the Poles would handle most of the heavy lifting, they needed some supplements, namely snipers and navigators. And so, in September 2004, I was pulled from my platoon and sent to Iraq to help the GROM as a navigator. The rest of the platoon was due to come overseas the following month. I'd meet them there. I felt bad about leaving Taya. She was still healing from the birth, but at the same time, I felt my duty as a SEAL was more important. I wanted to get back into action. I wanted to go to war. At that point, while I loved my son, I hadn't yet bonded with him. I was never one of those dads who liked to feel my wife's belly when the baby was kicking. I tend to need to know someone well, even kin, before that part of me grows. That changed over time, but at that point I still hadn't experienced the real depth of what being a father is all about. Generally, when SEALs go out for a deployment or come back, we do so very quietly. That's the nature of special operations. There are usually few people around except for immediate families, sometimes not even them. In this case, because of when I was heading out, it happened that I passed a small group of protesters demonstrating against the war. They had signs about baby killers and murderers and whatever, protesting the troops who were going over to fight. They were protesting the wrong people. We didn't vote in Congress. We didn't vote to go to war. I signed up to protect this country. I do not choose the wars. It happens that I love to fight, but I do not choose which battles I go to. Y'all send me to them. I had to wonder why these people weren't protesting at their congressional offices or in Washington. Protesting the people who were ordered to protect them. Let's just say it put a bad taste in my mouth. I realize not everybody felt that way. I did see signs on some homes supporting the troops, saying, "We love you," and that sort of thing. And there were plenty of tearful and respectful send-offs and homecomings, some even on TV. But it was the ignorant protesters I remembered, years and years later. And for the record, it doesn't bother me that SEALs don't have big send-offs or fancy homecomings. We are the silent professionals. We're covert operators, and inviting the media to the airport is not in the program. Still, it's nice to be thanked every so often for doing our job. Iraq. A lot had happened in Iraq since I left in the spring of 2003. The country had been liberated from Saddam Hussein and his army with the fall of Baghdad on April 9 of that year. But a variety of terrorist forces either continued or began fighting after Saddam was deposed. They fought both other Iraqis and the U.S. forces who were trying to help the country regain stability. Some were former members of Saddam's army and members of the Ba'athist party that Saddam had headed. They were Fedayeen, members of a paramilitary resistance group the dictator had organized before the war. There were small, poorly organized groups of Iraqi guerrillas who were also called Fedayeen, though technically they weren't connected with Saddam's organization. Though nearly all were Muslim, nationalism rather than religion tended to be their primary motive and organizing principle. Then there were the groups organized primarily around religious beliefs. These identified themselves as Mujahideen, which basically means people on jihad, or murderers in the name of God. They were dedicated to killing Americans and Muslims who didn't believe in the brand of Islam that they believed in. There was also Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a mostly foreign group that saw the war as an opportunity to kill Americans. They were radical Sunni Muslims with an allegiance to Osama bin Laden, the terrorist leader who needs no introduction, and whom SEALs hunted down and gave a fitting send-off in 2011. There were also Iranians in their Republican Guard who fought, sometimes directly, though usually through proxies, to both kill Americans and to gain power in Iraqi politics. I'm sure there were a hell of a lot of others in what came to be known to the media as the insurgency. They were all the enemy. I never worried too much about who exactly it was who was pointing a gun at me or planting an IED. The fact that they wanted to kill me was all I needed to know. Saddam was captured in December of 2003. In 2004, the U.S. formally turned over authority to the interim government, giving control of the country back to the Iraqis, at least in theory. But the insurgency grew tremendously that same year. A number of battles in the spring were as fierce as those waged during the initial invasion. In Baghdad, a hardline Shiite cleric named Muqtada al-Sadr organized an army of fanatical followers and urged them to attack Americans. Sadr was especially strong in a part of Baghdad known as Sadr City, a slum named after his father, Mohammed Sadegh al-Sadr, a grand ayatollah and an opponent of Saddam's regime during the 1990s. An extremely poor area, even by Iraqi standards, Sadr City was packed with radical Shiites. Said to be about half the size of Manhattan in area, Sadr City was located northeast of Baghdad's Green Zone on the far side of Army Canal and Imam Ali Street. A lot of the places where regular Iraqis live, even if they are considered middle class, look like slums to an American. Decades of Saddam's rule made what could have been a fairly rich country due to its oil reserves into a very poor one. Even in the better parts of the cities, a lot of the streets aren't paved and the buildings are pretty run down. Sadr City is truly a slum, even for Iraq. It began as a public housing area for the poor, and by the time of the war it had become a refuge for Shiites, who were discriminated against by Saddam's Sunni-dominated government. After the war started, even more Shiites moved into the area. I've seen reports estimating that more than 2 million people lived within its roughly 8 square miles. Laid out in a grid pattern, the streets are 50 or 100 yards long. Most areas have densely packed 2- and 3-story buildings. The workmanship on the buildings I saw was terrible. Even on the fanciest buildings, the decorative lines didn't match up from one side to the other. Many of the streets are open sewers with waste everywhere. Muqtada al-Sadr launched an offensive against American forces in the spring of 2004. His force managed to kill a number of American troops and a far greater number of Iraqis before the fanatical cleric declared a ceasefire in June. In military terms, his offensive failed, but the insurgents remained strong in Sadr City. Meanwhile, most Sunni insurgents took a hold of al-Anbar province, a large sector of the country to the west of Baghdad. They were particularly strong in the cities there, including Ramadi and Fallujah. That spring was the period when Americans were shocked by the images of 4 contractors, their bodies desecrated, hanging from a bridge in Fallujah. It was a sign of worse to come. The Marines moved into the city soon afterward, but their operations were called off after heavy fighting. It's been estimated that at that point they controlled some 25% of the city. As part of the pullout, an Iraqi force came into the city to take control. In theory, they were supposed to keep insurgents out. The reality was very different. By that fall, pretty much the only people who lived in Fallujah were insurgents. It was even more dangerous for Americans than it had been in the spring. When I left for Iraq in September of 2004, my unit had begun training to join a new operation to secure Fallujah once and for all. But I went to work with the Poles in Baghdad instead. With the Grom. Kyle, you will come. The Polish NCO doing the briefing stroked his bushy beard as he pointed at me. I didn't understand much Polish, and he didn't speak very good English, but what he was saying seemed pretty clear. They wanted me to go in the house with them during the operation. Fuck yeah, I said. He smiled. Some expressions are universal. After a week on the job, I had been promoted from navigator to a member of the assault team. I couldn't be happier. I still had to navigate. My job was to figure out a safe route to and from the target house. While the insurgents were active in the Baghdad area, the fighting had slowed down and there wasn't yet the huge threat of IEDs and ambushes that you saw elsewhere. Still, that could change in an instant, and I was careful plotting my routes. We got into our Hummers and set out. I had the front seat next to the driver. I'd learned enough Polish to give directions. Prawo kole, right turn, and guide him through the streets. The computer was on my lap. To my right was a swing arm for a machine gun. We'd taken the Hummer's doors off to make it easier to get in and out and fire. Besides the mounts on my side and in the back, we had a 50 and a turret at the back. We reached the target and hauled ass out of the truck. I was psyched to finally get back into battle. The Poles put me about 6th or 7th in the line to go in. That was a bit disappointing. That far back in the train, you're unlikely to get any action. But I wasn't about to bitch. The Grom hit houses essentially the way SEALs do. There are little variations here and there. The way they come around corners, for example, and the way they cover buddies during an operation. But for the most part, it's all violence of action. Surprise the target, hit them hard and fast, take control. One difference I particularly like is their version of flash crash grenades. American stun grenades explode with flash of light and an enormous bang. The Polish grenades, on the other hand, give a series of explosions. We called them seven bangers. They sound like very loud gunfire. I tried to take as many of those from them as I could when it was time to move on. We moved the instant the grenade started going off. I came in through the door and caught sight of the NCO directing the team. He motioned me forward silently, and I ran to clear and secure my room. The room was empty. All clear. I went back downstairs. Some of the others had found the guy we'd come for and were already loading him into one of the Hummers. The rest of the Iraqis who'd been in the house stood around looking scared to death. Back outside, I hopped into the Hummer and started directing the team back to base. The mission was uneventful, but as far as the Grom were concerned, my cherry had been burst. From that point on, I was a full-fledged member of the team. Buffalo Piss Vodka. We went on DAs for another 2.5 weeks, but there was only one where we had anything like real trouble. A guy wanted to fight as we were going in. Unfortunately for him, all he had were his bare fists. Here he's facing a squad of soldiers, each heavily armed and protected by body armor. He was either stupid or courageous, or maybe both. The Grom took care of him quickly, one less asshole on the wanted list. We picked up a pretty wide variety of suspects, financiers for Al-Qaeda, bomb makers, insurgents, foreign insurgents. One time we picked up a truckload of them. The Grom were a lot like SEALs, extremely professional at work, and very hardcore partiers after hours. They all had Polish vodka, and they especially loved this one brand named Zubrówka. Zubrówka had been around for hundreds of years, though I've never seen it in America. There's a blade of buffalo grass in each bottle. Each blade comes from the same field in Poland. Buffalo grass is supposed to have medicinal properties, but the story related to me from my Grom friends was a lot more colorful, or maybe off-color. According to them, European bison, known as vicent, roam on this field and piss on the grass. The distillers put the blades in for an extra kick. Actually, during the process, certain ingredients of the buffalo grass are safely neutralized, so just the flavor remains. But my friends didn't tell me that. Maybe it was too hard to translate. I was a little dubious, but the vodka proved to be as smooth as it was potent. It definitely supported their argument that the Russians don't know anything about vodka and that Poles make it better. Being an American, officially I wasn't supposed to be drinking, and officially I didn't. That asinine rule only applied to U.S. servicemen. We couldn't even buy a beer. Every other member of the coalition, be they Polish or whatever, could. Fortunately, the Grom liked to share. They would also go to the duty-free shop at Baghdad Airport and buy beer or whiskey or whatever the Americans working with them wanted. I formed a friendship with one of their snipers named Matthew. They all took fake names as part of their general security. We spent a lot of time talking about different rifles and scenarios. We compared notes on how they did things, the weapons they would use. Later on, I arranged to run some drills with them and gave them a bit of background on how SEALs operate. I taught them how we build our hides inside homes and showed them a few different drills to use to take home and train. We worked a lot with snaps, targets that pop up, and movers, targets that move left to right and vice versa. What always seemed interesting to me was how well we communicated without using words, even on an op. They'd turn around and wave me up or back, whatever. If you're a professional, you don't need to be told what to do. You read off each other and react. Geared up. People are always asking me what sort of gear I carried in Iraq. The answer is, it depended. I adjusted my gear slightly from deployment to deployment. Here's how I usually went out. Pistols. The standard SEAL-issued pistol was a Sig Sauer P226 chambered for 9mm ammo. While that is an excellent weapon, I felt I needed more knockdown power than 9mm could provide, and later started carrying my own personal weapon in place of the P226. Let's face it, if you're using a pistol in combat, the shit has already hit the fan. You may not have the time for perfect shot placement. The bigger rounds may not kill your enemy, but they're more likely to put him down when you hit him. In 2004, I brought over a Springfield TRP operator, which used a .45 caliber round. It had a 1911 body style with custom grips and a rail system that let me add a light and laser combo. Black. It had a bull barrel and was an excellent gun, until it took a frag for me in Fallujah. I was actually able to get it repaired. Those Springfields are tough. Still, not wanting to press my luck, I replaced it with the Sig P220. The P220 looked pretty much exactly like the P226, but was chambered for .45 caliber. Carrying my pistol. On my first two deployments, I had a drop leg holster. A drop leg sits against the upper thigh within easy reach of the pistol hand. The problem with that type of holster is that it tends to move around. During combat, or even if you're simply bouncing around, the rig slides over on your leg. So after the first two deployments, I went to a hip holster. That way, my gun was always where I expected it to be. Med gear. Everyone always carried their own blowout kit, a small set of medical supplies. You always carried the bare necessities to treat a gunshot wound. Bandages for different wounds, IV, clotting medicine. It had to be readily accessible. You didn't want the person helping you to have to search for it. I put mine in my right-hand cargo pocket on my leg, under the holster. If I'd ever been shot, my buddies could have cut out the bottom of my cargo pocket and pulled out the kit. Most guys did it that way. When you treat somebody in the field before the corpsman or a medic gets there, you always use the wounded man's kit. If you use your kit, who's to say you'll have it for the next guy, or yourself if you need it? Body armor and rig. During the first deployment, my SEAL body armor had the MOLLE system attached to it. MOLLE stands for Modular Lightweight Load Carrying Equipment, a fancy acronym for a web system where different pouches and gear can be attached, allowing you to customize your webbing. The word MOLLE itself is a trademark for the system developed and manufactured by Natick Labs. However, a lot of people use the word to describe any similar system. On the deployments that followed, I had separate body armor with a separate Rhodesian rig. Rhodesian describes a vest that allows you to set up a MOLLE or MOLLE-like rig. Again, the overall principle is that you can customize the way you carry your stuff. Having a separate vest allowed me to take my gear off and lay it down while still wearing my body armor. This made it more comfortable to lie down and still be able to grab everything I needed. When I was going to be on the sniper rifle, lying behind it and peering through the scope, I would unclip the strap and lay out the vest. This made my ammo, which I had in the pouches, easier to access. Meanwhile, the vest was still attached to my shoulders. It would come with me and fall into place when I got up. One note about the body armor. Navy-issued body armor has been known to fall apart. In light of that fact, my wife's parents very generously bought me some dragon skin armor after my third deployment. It's super heavy, but it's extremely good armor, the best you can get. I wore a GPS on my wrist with a backup in my vest and even a backup old-fashioned compass. I went through a couple of pairs of goggles per deployment. They had miniature fans inside to keep air circulating so they wouldn't fog up. And, of course, I had a pocket knife. I got a Microtech after graduating Buds, and Emerson and Benchmade fixed blades, depending on the deployment. Among other equipment we'd carry would be a square of a VS-17 panel, used to alert pilots to a friendly position so they wouldn't fire on us. In theory, at least. Initially, I tried to keep everything off my waist, even going so far as to carry my extra pistol mags and another drop leg on my other side. I cinched it up high so I could still access the pocket on my left leg. I never wore ear protection in Iraq. The ear protection we had contained noise-canceling circuitry. While it was possible to hear gunshots fired by the enemy, the microphone that picked up those sounds was omnidirectional. That meant you couldn't tell what direction the shots were coming from. And contrary to what my wife thinks, I wore my helmet from time to time. Admittedly, it was not often. It was a standard U.S. military-issue helmet, uncomfortable and of minimal value against all but the weakest shots or shrapnel. To keep it from jostling on my head, I tightened it up using Pro-Tec pads, but it was still annoying to wear for long stretches. It added a lot of weight to my head while I was on the gun, making it harder to stay focused as the watch went on. I'd seen that bullets, even from pistols, could easily go through a helmet, so I didn't have much incentive to deal with the discomfort. The general exception to this was at night. I'd wear the helmet so I had a place to attach my night vision to. Otherwise, I usually wore a ball cap, a platoon cap with the Cadillac symbol adapted as our unit logo. While officially we were Charlie Platoon, we usually took on alternate names with the same letter or sound at the beginning. Charlie becomes Cadillac, etc. Why a ball cap? 90% of being cool is looking cool, and you look so much cooler wearing a ball cap. Besides my Cadillac cap, I had another favorite, a cap from a New York fire company that had lost some of its men during 9/11. My dad had gotten it for me during a visit, after the attacks, to the Lion's Den, a historic city firehouse. There he met members of Engine 23 when the firemen heard that his son was going to war. They insisted he take the hat. "Just tell him to get some payback," they said. If they're hearing this, I hope they know that I did. On my wrist, I'd wear a G-Shock watch. The black watch and its rubber wristband have replaced Rolex Submariners as standard SEAL equipment. A friend of mine who thought it was a shame the tradition died recently got me one. I still feel a little strange wearing a Rolex, but it is a throwback to the frogmen who came before me. In cool weather, I brought a personal jacket to wear, a North Face, because, believe it or not, I had trouble convincing the supply mafia to issue me cold weather gear. But that's a rant for a different day. I would stick my M4 and 10 mags, 300 rounds, in the front compartments of my web gear. I would also have my radio, some lights, and my strobe in those pockets. The strobe can be used at night for rendezvousing with other units or aircraft, ships, boats, whatever. It also can be used to identify friendly troops. If I had one of my sniper rifles with me, I would have some 200 rounds in my backpack. When I carried the MK-11 instead of the Win Mag or 338, then I wouldn't bother carrying the M4. In that case, the sniper rounds would be in my web gear, closer at hand. Rounding out my ammo were 3 mags for my pistol. I wore Merrell high-top hiking boots. They were comfortable and held up to the deployment. Get up, Kyle. About a month into my tour with the Grom, I was woken by a shake on my shoulder. I jumped upright in bed, ready to deck whoever had snuck into my quarters. Hey, it's cool, said the lieutenant commander who'd woken me. He was a SEAL and my boss. I need you to get dressed and come to my office. Yes, sir, I mumbled. I pulled on a pair of shorts and my flip-flops and went down the hall. I thought I was in trouble, though I wasn't sure what for. I'd been on good behavior working with the Poles, no fights to speak of. I searched my mind as I walked toward his office trying to prepare a defense. My mind was still fairly blank when I got there. Kyle, I'm going to need you to get your sniper rifle and pack up all your gear, the lieutenant commander told me. You're going to Fallujah. He started telling me about some of the arrangements and threw in some operational details. The Marines were planning a big push, and they needed snipers to help out. Man, this is going to be good, I thought. We're going to kill massive amounts of bad guys, and I'm going to be in the middle of it. An armed camp. From a historical point of view, there were two battles for Fallujah. The first took place in the spring, as I've mentioned before. Political considerations, mostly driven by wildly distorted media reports and a lot of Arab propaganda, caused the Marines to back off their offensive soon after it was begun, and well before it achieved its aim of kicking the insurgents out of the city. In place of the Marines, Iraqis loyal to the interim government were supposed to take control and run the city. That didn't work. Pretty much the moment the Marines pulled back, the insurgents completely took over Fallujah. Civilians who were not connected with the insurgency were killed or fled the city. Anyone who wanted peace, anyone with any sense, left as soon as they could or ended up dead. Al-Anbar province, the area that contained the city, was studded with insurgents of various forms. A lot were Iraqi Mujahideen, but there were also plenty of foreign nationals who were members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq or other radical groups. The head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Sheikh Abdullah al-Janabi, had his headquarters in the city. A Jordanian who had fought with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, he was committed to killing Americans. Despite numerous reports to the contrary, as far as is known, Sheikh Abdullah al-Janabi escaped from Fallujah and is still at large. The insurgents were one part terrorists and another part criminal gangs. They would plant IEDs, kidnap officials and their families, attack American convoys, kill Iraqis who didn't share their faith or politics. Anything and everything they could think of. Fallujah had become their safe haven, an anti-capital of Iraq dedicated to overthrowing the interim government and preventing free elections. Al-Anbar province, and more specifically the general area around Fallujah, became known through the media as the Sunni Triangle. That's a very, very rough approximation both of the area, contained between Baghdad, Ramadi, and Bakuba, and the ethnic composition. Some background on Islam in Iraq. There were two main groups of Muslims in Iraq, Sunnis and Shiites. Before the war, Shiites lived mostly in the south and east, say from Baghdad to the borders, and Sunnis dominated around Baghdad and to the northwest. The two groups coexisted but generally hated each other. While Shiites were the majority, during Saddam's time they were discriminated against and not allowed to hold important offices. Farther north, the areas are dominated by Kurds, who, though mostly Sunni, have separate traditions and often don't think of themselves as being part of Iraq. Saddam considered them to be an inferior people. During one political suppression, he ordered chemical weapons used and waged a despicable ethnic cleansing campaign. While using Fallujah as a base to attack the surrounding area in Baghdad, the insurgents spent considerable time fortifying the city so they could withstand another attack. They stockpiled ammo and weapons, prepared IEDs, and fortified houses. Mines were planted and roads closed off so they could be used for ambushes. Rat holes were created in compound walls, allowing insurgents to move from one house to another, avoiding streets. Many, if not all, of the 200 mosques in the city became fortified bunkers, since the insurgents knew that Americans respected houses of worship as sacred and therefore were reluctant to attack there. A hospital was turned into an insurgent headquarters and used as a base of operations for the insurgents' propaganda machine. In sum, the city was a terrorist fortress by the summer of 2004. In fact, the insurgents were confident enough to regularly launch rocket attacks against U.S. bases in the area and ambush convoys moving on the main roads. Finally, the American command decided that enough was enough. Fallujah had to be retaken. The plan they drew up was called Phantom Fury. The city would be cut off so that enemy supplies and reinforcements could no longer get in. The insurgents in Fallujah would be rooted out and destroyed. While Marines from the 1st Marine Division made up the backbone of the attack force, all of the other services added key pieces. SEAL snipers were integrated with small marine assault groups, providing overwatch and performing traditional sniper missions. The Marines spent several weeks getting ready for the assault, launching a variety of operations to throw the insurgents off balance. The bad guys knew something was coming, they just didn't know where and when. The eastern side of the city was heavily fortified, and the enemy probably thought that's where the attack would be launched. Instead, the attack would come from the northwest and roll down into the heart of the city. That's where I was headed. Getting there. Dismissed by the lieutenant commander, I immediately gathered my gear, then headed outside to a pickup truck that was waiting to take me out to the helo. A 60, a Blackhawk H-60, was waiting for me and another guy who'd been working with the Grom, a comm specialist named Adam. We looked at each other and smiled. We were thrilled to be getting into a real battle. SEALs from all over Iraq were making a similar trip, heading toward the large Marine base south of the city at Camp Fallujah. They'd already established their own small base inside the camp by the time I arrived. I treaded my way through the narrow halls of the building, which had been dubbed the Alamo, trying not to knock into anything. The walls were lined with equipment and gear, gun boxes and metal suitcases, cartons and the odd box of soda. We could have been a traveling rock band staging a stadium roadshow. Except that our roadshow had very serious pyrotechnics. Besides snipers from Team 3, men had been pulled from Team 5 and Team 8 to join the assault. I already knew most of the West Coast guys, the others I'd come to respect over the next few weeks. The energy level was intense. Everyone was eager to get into the fight and help the Marines. The home front. As the battle drew near, my thoughts wandered to my wife and son. My little baby boy was growing. Taya had started sending me photos and even videos showing his progress. She'd also sent images through email for me to look at. I can see some of those videos now in my mind. He'd be lying on his back and shake his hands and feet, going as if he was running, a big old smile on his face. He was a super active kid, just like his daddy. Thanksgiving, Christmas, in Iraq, those dates didn't mean all that much to me. But missing my son's experience of them was a little different. The more I was gone, and the more I saw him grow, the more I wanted to help him grow. Do the things a father does with and for a son. I called Taya while I was waiting for the assault to begin. It was a brief conversation. Look, babe, I can't tell you where I'm going, but I'm going to be gone for a while, I said. Watch the news and you'll figure it out. I don't know when I'm going to be able to talk to you again. That was going to have to do for a while. It begins. On the evening of November 7, I squeezed into a Marine Amtrak with a dozen Marines and a few SEALs, all keyed up for battle. The big armored vehicle rumbled to life and slowly moved toward the head of a massive procession of armor heading out of camp and north of the city into the open desert. We sat knee to knee on benches facing each other in the bare bones interior. A third row had been squeezed into the middle of the compartment. The AAV-7A1 wasn't exactly a stretch limo. You might try to not crowd out the guys on either side of you, but there was only so much you could do. Tight wasn't the word. Thankfully, just about everyone inside with me had showered recently. At first, it was cold. This was November, and to a Texas boy, it felt like deep winter. But within a few minutes, the heater was choking us, and we had to ask them to crank it down. I put my ruck down on the floor. With my Mark 11 propped between my legs and my helmet on the butt, I had a makeshift pillow. I tried to nap as we moved. Close your eyes, and time moves faster. I didn't get all that much sleep. Ever so often, I glanced toward the slit windows in the rear door, but I couldn't see past the guys sitting there. That wasn't much of a loss. All they could see was the rest of the procession, a haze of dust and a few patches of empty desert. We'd been practicing with the Marines for about a week, going over everything from getting in and out of their vehicles to figuring out exactly what sort of charges we would use to blow sniper holes through buildings. In between, we'd worked on radio comms and general strategy, exchanged ideas about how to provide the best cover for the squads we'd be accompanying, and made a dozen tentative tactical decisions, such as deciding whether it would be generally better to shoot from the top floor or the one right below. Now we were ready, but as often happens in the military, we were in hurry-up-and-wait mode. The tracked vehicles drove us up north of Fallujah, then stopped. We sat there for what seemed like hours, every muscle in my body cramped. Finally, someone decided we could drop the ramp and stretch a bit. I unfolded myself from the bench and went out to shoot the shit with some of the other SEALs nearby. Finally, just before daybreak, we loaded back up and began trundling toward the edge of the city. There was maximum adrenaline inside that tin can on treads. We were ready to get it on. Our destination was an apartment complex overlooking the northwestern corner of the city. Roughly 800 yards from the start of the city proper, the buildings had a perfect view of the area where our Marines were going to launch their assault, an excellent location for snipers. All we had to do was take it. 5 minutes, yelled one of the NCOs. I hooked one arm through my ruck and got a good grip on my gun. The Amtrak jerked to a halt. The rear ramp slammed down, and I leapt out with the others, running toward a small grove with some trees and rocks for cover. I moved quickly. I wasn't afraid of getting shot as much as I was of being run over by one of the armada that had ferried us there. The mammoth Amtraks didn't look like they'd stop for anybody. I hit the dirt, got the ruck next to me, and began scanning the building, watching for anything suspicious. I worked my eyes around the windows and the surrounding area, expecting all the while to be shot at. The Marines, meanwhile, poured out of their vehicles. Besides the tracked personnel carriers, there were Hummers and tanks and dozens of support vehicles. The Marines just kept coming, swarming over the complex. They started kicking in doors. I couldn't hear much, just the loud echoes of the shotguns they used to blow out the locks. The Marines detained a few women who had been outside, but otherwise the yard around the building was vacant. My eyes never stopped moving. I scanned constantly, trying to find something. Our radio guy came over and set up nearby. He was monitoring the Marine progress as they worked up through the apartment building, securing it. The few inhabitants they found inside had to be taken out and moved to safety. There was no resistance inside. If there were insurgents, they'd either gotten out when they saw us coming, or they pretended now that they were loyal Iraqis and friends of the U.S. The Marines ended up moving about 250 civilians from the complex, a fraction of what they had been told to expect. Each one was questioned first. Assuming they hadn't fired a weapon recently, the Marines did gunpowder checks, weren't on a wanted list, or were not otherwise suspicious, the head of each family was given $300 and told they had to leave. According to one of the Marine officers, they were allowed to go back to their apartments, take what they needed, and leave. A few known insurgents were captured and detained in the operation. While we were on the berm watching the city, we were also watching warily for an Iraqi sniper known as Mustafa. From the reports we heard, Mustafa was an Olympics marksman who was using his skills against Americans and Iraqi police and soldiers. Several videos had been made and posted, boasting of his ability. I never saw him, but other snipers later killed an Iraqi sniper we think was him. To the apartments. All right, said our radio guy finally. They want us inside. I ran from the trees to the apartment complex where a SEAL lieutenant was organizing the overwatches. He had a map of the city and showed us where the assault was going to take place the next day. We need to cover this area here, here, and here, he said. Y'all go find a room to do it. He gave us a building, and off we went. I'd been paired with the sniper I'd met during BUDS, Ray. I've used the name to protect his identity. Ray is a big-time gun nut, loves guns, and knows 'em real well. I'm not sure how good a shot he is, but he's probably forgotten more than I know about rifles. We hadn't seen each other for years, but from what I remembered from BUDS, I figured we'd get along all right. You want to feel confident the guy you're working with is someone you can rely on. After all, you are literally trusting him with your life. A ranger we called Ranger Malloy had been shepherding our rifles and some gear with us in a Hummer. He came up and gave me my 300 Win Mag. The rifle's extra distance over the Mark 11 would be handy once I found a good hide to shoot from. Running up the stairs, I sorted the situation out in my head. I knew what side of the building I wanted to be on, and roughly where I wanted to be, When I reached the top, I decided I wanted to shoot from a room rather than the roof. I started walking through the hall, scanning for an apartment that had the right view. Going inside, I looked for one with furniture I could use to set up. To me, the home I was in was just another part of the battlefield. The apartments and everything in them were just things to be used to accomplish our goal, clearing the city. Snipers need to either lie down or sit for a long period of time, so I needed to find furniture that would let me do that as comfortably as possible. You also need something to rest your rifle on. In this case, I was going to be shooting out of the windows, so I needed to be elevated. As I searched through the apartment, I found a room that had a baby crib in it. It was a rare find, and one I could put to good use. Ray and I took it and flipped it over. That gave us a base. Then we pulled the door of the room off its hinges and put it on top. Now we had a stable platform to work on. Most Iraqis don't sleep on beds. They use bed rolls, thick mats, or blankets that are put directly on the floor. We found a few of them and laid them out on the door. That made a semi-comfortable elevated bed to lie on while working the gun. A rolled mat gave us a place to rest the end of our guns on. We opened the window and were ready to shoot. We decided we'd work 3 hours on, 3 hours off, rotating back and forth. Ray took the first watch. I started rummaging through the complex to see if I could find any cool shit. Money, guns, explosives. The only thing I found worth acquisitioning was a handheld Tiger Woods golf game. Not that I was authorized to take it, or even did take it, officially. If I had taken it, I would have played it the rest of the deployment. If I'd done that, it might explain why I'm actually pretty good at the game now. If I had taken it. I got on the 300 Win Mag in late afternoon. The city I was looking out at was brownish yellow and gray, almost as if everything was shaded the light sepia of an old photograph. Many, though not all, of the buildings were made of bricks or covered with stucco in the same color. The stones and roadways were gray. A fine mist of desert dust seemed to hover over the houses. There were trees and other vegetation, but the overall landscape looked like a collection of dully painted boxes in the desert. Most of the buildings were squat houses, 2 stories high, occasionally 3 or 4. Minarets or prayer towers poked out of the grayness at irregular intervals. There were mosque domes scattered around. Here a green egg flanked by a dozen smaller eggs, there a white turnip glinting white in the sinking sun. The buildings were packed in tight, the streets almost geometrical in their grid pattern. There were walls everywhere. The city had already been at war for some time, and there was plenty of rubble not only around the edges but in the main thoroughfares. Dead ahead of me but out of view was the infamous bridge where the insurgents had desecrated the bodies of the Blackwater contractors half a year earlier. The bridge spanned the Euphrates, which flowed in an inverted V just south of my position. My immediate concern was a set of railroad tracks about 800 yards from the building. There was a berm and a train trestle over the highway south of me. To the east, on my left, as I looked out the window, the train line ran to a switching yard and station outside the main part of the city. The Marine assault would sweep across the tracks, driving down and into an area from the Euphrates to a highway at the eastern end of the city, marked by a clover leaf. This was an area roughly 3 1/3 miles wide. The plan was to move about a mile and a half deep to Iraqi Route 10 by November 10, a little less than 3 days. That might not seem like a lot. Most Marines can probably walk that far in a half hour. But the path lay through a rat's nest of booby-trapped streets and past heavily armed houses. Not only did the Marines expect to be fighting literally house to house and block to block, but they also realized that things would probably get worse as they went. You push the rats from one hole, and they congregate in the next. Sooner or later, they run out of places to run. Looking out the window, I was anxious for the battle to start. I wanted a target. I wanted to shoot someone. I didn't have to wait all that long. From the building, I had a prime view across the railroad tracks and the berm, and then beyond that, into the city. I started getting kills soon after I got on the gun. Most were back in the area near the city. Insurgents would move into that area, trying to get into position to attack or maybe spy on the Marines. They were about 800 meters away, across the railroad tracks and below the berm, so probably, in their mind, they couldn't be seen and were safe. They were badly mistaken.